Something you may not know is that all the like macro data would say the average American churchgoer attends church 1.7 times per month. I don't know how you attend church 0.7 times. Some of y'all aren't fully here, so I guess that kind of counts. But what that means is, and as your church home here, what that can mean is that as we try to communicate things and announce some things and share some things, kind of the life of the church, it can mean that if we announce it one Sunday, it means that potentially over half of our people who would say Chill South is our home aren't here. Now, some of y'all are here every week, and some of y'all are here, you know, once every 8 weeks. We know. We're watching. No. But what that means is that it really becomes hard to, like, keep everybody up to speed, and we send emails and texts and announcements and all that, but it's difficult, especially across multiple services. What that means is that I'm going to announce something. Some of you have heard it a bunch of times, and some of you haven't even heard it because you're like, well, I didn't know that. And it's like, well, you haven't been here. And we really want to try in this season that we're in, macro season as a church, and have been in, to be over. We want you to hear this all the time, and we want to keep you up to speed. We want to be transparent. We want to be in sync. And so just bear with us as we're trying to make sure that this is communicated, keeps being communicated. But the news as of like 6 months ago is that we entered into really like 4.5 months ago, we were under contract, or we entered into a contract to own this corner, which is amazing. It's huge news. If you clapped, it means it's the first time you've heard it. So that's, I'm kidding. It's old news. What that means is that this corner, we are now officially under contract. Our members have voted. As of like a month ago, we are under contract. Here's where that takes us and where that places us is that beautifully the owners here for this corner, the building we're in now, all the way through the house behind us, all the way to the alleyway that we are now under contract for, they are going to give us some time post being under contract officially to then close. They're going to give us a long runway. And here's why they're doing that. We entered into a capital campaign a couple of years ago, not knowing what our life would be with the owners, wanting to stay here permanently. Are they going to sell it to us? Are they going to give us a long-term lease? But we need to raise some money to be ready to move when they're ready. And so many of y'all beautifully by faith went on that journey with us that didn't have all the crystal clarity. And so we raised some money. We had $9.5 million pledged to that end, not knowing if we were going to buy or lease from them and needing to do some renovations and some additions and all that kind of stuff. They now sold to us. The sale price is $11 million. Okay, I'm gonna do some quick math. $11 million sale price, it's really 10.8, rolling some closing costs around $11 million to close on this place with no debt. 9.5 was pledged 2.5 years ago during our capital campaign. That leaves about $1.5 million from pledged to total purchase all in to be debt-free here. It would be amazing to have $11 million to bring to closing so that we're debt-free on this corner. It'd be amazing. We would hope for that. In the 9.5 that was pledged in the last 2.5 or so years, only 6.7, 6.8 of the 9.5 pledging has been turned into cash. So thank you if you've turned your pledge into cash. We're about 6.8 needing to get to 11 of cash. That's why the owners are giving us a long runway after being under contract before we close. Because they're saying, take some more time if you need it to then raise, get the pledges turned into dollars and to close the gap as much as you can so you can come to closing with as much cash as possible so you can enter into the least amount of debt, okay? I was a math minor, so I'm pretty good at this. But true story. But I also need you to know this, if you haven't been around, we have this historic value that is beautiful in this department where zero of the pastoral staff, zero of the staff, zero of the elders know who gives what here, which is awesome. It frees us up. We get to be your shepherds and we get to be your staff and care for you, and it's not based on what you give. We don't even know if you give. And so there's this reality of like, we don't know. And we love that. What that does though is it does limit us just a little bit that if you pledged 2.5 years ago, but your pledge hasn't been turned into cash, we don't even know who to follow up with. Like, hey, you pledged X, but it hasn't come in. Could we talk? Do you have questions? Did you lose the email? Did you forget that you pledged? Like, we don't even know how to do that because we don't know. Now, there is a way through, we can get an email like that sent out with still without us knowing through the kind of the donations department, but we still will not know the names. So here's what we're asking. With the value that we're trying to keep of none of the leadership here, the staff here knows who gives what, We like that. It also means that in this stretch of trying to close this gap between what's been pledged, what we're purchasing for, wanting to close sooner than later on this, we need you to do, like, we need you to be proactive and going, oh yeah, I did pledge, or I don't remember if I pledged. Did I pledge and have I turned it into cash yet? Because we won't be able to track that down. So up here, I have a postcard and a one-sheet-er on the campaign itself and close the gap between where we're at and where we want to get to before closing. There's a bunch of those up here. There's those in the back. Our campaign was called Living a Legacy, so you'll see this on these flyers and stuff. You've probably already heard this. I know half of you have. 1.7 of you are hearing it for the first time today. But there's a reality of, hey, we need your help in closing this gap. The owners are giving us until January to close, which is amazing. But we would love to close sooner than that if possible, because what that wire trips once we're able to close is beginning to look over the horizon at what, Lord, would we be able to maybe do on this corner to build and expand and to renovate and those kinds of things. On that front, just a little update, because we want you to know these things too. We gathered a wonderful group of humans this past spring, and we sent a survey out to the members and volunteers here. Hey, what do you love about this space? What do you not like about this space? What do you want to see happen on this property for our church and for the neighborhood? We asked all that stuff. Not a whole lot of people said they like the preaching. It's fine. They like the red doors, though. They want to keep the red doors rock solid. That's great. I'm fine with that. No, there was a lot of great data. We mined a ton of data. We prayed through a ton of things. We had a great team, kind of a vision and values team for our future here. That team has finished their work. They've given those values to the elders here. The elders have worked through those, and now we are engaging some architects, learning architectural language like RFPs and RFQs, and I know some stuff. And the architects are being sent the proposals, and we're getting stuff back from them in the next couple weeks. That is what's going on now. As we get into the fall, we will be engaging some builders, get some estimates. Like, we're a long way off from breaking any ground, but I just wanted y'all to know that's kind of, we're working a lot behind the scenes to try to be faithful with this incredible gift that the Lord has given us. And for now, closing the gap on allowing us to close with as little debt as possible would be huge for our future. So that's the ask. If you got any questions about our vision, about our why, about our campaign, about our future, please come find me, come find an elder. We would love a staff, a pastor. We would love to talk to you about what we believe the Lord is calling us to here, and all of us together to stay on this corner. So that is it by way of campaign update. And again, you will hear this hopefully because we want to just be transparent with you and continue to bring you up to speed on that. If you're visiting today, no one asked you here for your money. I hope you just enjoy this service as a gift to you. But if you're a member here or you've been around, we wanted to keep you updated on that front as well. So stopping on that, then we're going to move into our sermon portion of the worship service. We are in a series on the life of Jesus in the Gospel of John. We're calling our series The Misunderstood Messiah, because seemingly everywhere Jesus goes in the book of John, he is misunderstood, and not just misunderstood by those that hated him and opposed him, but he's misunderstood by the people that spent all their time with him. Like, they still don't, they're not tracking, they don't get the king, they don't get the kingdom, they don't understand why he does what he does and when he decides to do it. They don't understand his timing, they don't understand his teaching, and so all this misunderstanding is growing, and now we come to chapter 13, we're like in the second half of the book, and there's still misunderstanding abounds. And his misunderstanding, Jesus's being misunderstood by others will lead him to his death, and he's still willing to be misunderstood. Like, that's what's incredible about this misunderstood Messiah, is that he doesn't let being misunderstood draw him away from those that he came to serve and love. He actually stays on mission to keep loving them and keep serving them and keep teaching them, knowing that they don't understand it. So here we come to another remarkable story. This is the evening that the Last Supper begins. Jesus is nearing, you know, his final hours of living before his death and resurrection. And so we come to the upper room. We come to the Last Supper. And this is John chapter 13, if you want to turn there. We're going to read 20 or so verses of John 13 and get this story before us. So John chapter 13, starting in verse 1, says this. It'll be on the screen if you don't have your Bibles or your phones. It says, "Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God and was going back to God, rose from supper. He laid aside his outer garments and, taking a towel, tied it around his waist. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, do you wash my feet?" Jesus answered him, here's our theme for the series, "What I am doing you do not understand now, but afterward you will understand." Peter said to him, "You shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash you, you have no share with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, do not my feet, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." Jesus said to him, "The one who has bathed does not need to wash except for his feet, but is completely clean, and you are clean, but not every one of you." For he knew he was going to betray him, and that was why he said, "Not all of you are clean." When he had washed their feet and put on his outer garments and resumed his place, he said to them, here's our theme, "Do you understand what I have done to you?" The answer is no. "You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you also should do just as I have done to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. I'm not speaking to all of you. I know whom I have chosen, but the scripture will be fulfilled. He who ate my bread has lifted his heel against me." He's talking about Judas. "I'm telling you this now, before it takes place, that when it does take place, you may believe that I am he. Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever receives the one I send receives me, and whoever receives me receives the one that sent me." It's the word of the Lord. Amen. All right, the Last Supper. Last Supper scene. It's very well known. Church history would tell us that churches, and still globally to this day during Holy Week, celebrate this scene, this moment, on Thursday of Holy Week, leading into Good Friday and Easter Sunday. We do not have a Maundy Thursday service. A lot of churches do. Maundy Thursday is this moment. It comes from the Latin, like, mandate. That's where that word Maundy comes from. Maundy, mandate, Thursday is, this is the moment that Jesus gives the mandate to go and serve the world as he has served them. That's that last half of the section we were in. The mandate of Jesus, the Maundy of Jesus, go out and serve. But it's kind of become, it's been conflated to Maundy Thursday means the foot washing scene. That's what we're talking about. Maundy Thursday is the remembering of this moment. And proper hospitality in the ancient Near East would tell you, and hospitality is like the highest value in the ancient Near East, still in many parts of the Near East today, but it would tell you when a guest comes to your house, Jewish or not, it's not even just the Jews who practice hospitality in the Near East, it would say to you, especially in the first century, that their feet had been so muddied and gotten so disgusting from walking on dusty roads everywhere, and there was animal manure all in the roads, that when you came into a house, proper hospitality would have a slave come to you immediately and take off their garments and take off their outer coats and then their towels wrapped around them, and they would wash the guest's feet, not just as a sign of honor, but of dignity. And we want to wash your feet because it's been so muddied and stained by the world out there that we want to honor you in our home. But it was such a demeaning task to wash the manure and the mud and the dirt off of their feet that they'd been walking around in their sandals in, that in Jewish households, Jewish slaves, like if you were a Jew that was a slave in a house, a bondservant, you weren't even allowed to do the foot washing. The Jewish master would not let you do the foot washing because it would make you ceremonially unclean for the temple. It was so disgusting. It was so demeaning. It was such a low task that they would have their Gentile servants do the foot washing. It was beneath even the Jewish slaves to do because of what it would have done to them ceremonially for their worship and their sacrifices. And they would have had to go through all kinds of other ceremonial practices to get clean enough to go back to the temple. And so this is the moment we're walking in. Like these disciples have this upper room. Peter's helped secure it. They go in and they get into the room to have the Last Supper. And this is the scene that unfolds. Jesus, we're told in the book of Luke, this is what's awesome about having a story be in multiple gospels, because you get different colors on the canvas of this moment. Luke would tell us that right before this moment, think about what this conversation adds to the story we just read of Jesus washing their feet, is that right before this scene happens, listen to what Luke tells us in his gospel, says, a dispute also arose among the disciples as to which of them was to be regarded as the greatest. It doesn't say who it was that asked the question, but we can guess that Peter's like, hey, James and John, like, why don't you ask Jesus, which one of us is like the best disciple? Like, I know we're going to eat like this meal up there with him and whatever that means, but like, I want to know who like gets the trophy of like, who's the greatest one among us? And Jesus, without even answering their question, they're arguing, a dispute arose among them as to who, which of them is the greatest. Without even saying a word, Jesus, verse 4, rose from supper, laid aside his outer garments, and taking a towel, tied it around his waist, and began to wash their feet. Like, that is his answer. They're all fighting at the table. Who do you think's the best? And Jesus quietly gets up, doesn't even say anything, and answers their question. He demonstrates with a foot washing as to say to them, do you know the greatest among you will serve other people? The master gets up from the table to serve those beneath him. One Middle Eastern scholar, a guy named Kenneth Bailey, he's written a bunch. He was a Middle Eastern scholar for a long time. He wrote a book called Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes. You should go buy that book and read that book. He says this about this moment. He says, there is no instance in either Jewish or Greco-Roman sources of a superior washing the feet of an inferior. He says, I know of no incident in contemporary life. He wrote this book about 30 or 40 years ago. He says, I know of no incident in contemporary life or in stories out of the past of the Middle East where such an incredible reversal of roles and status appears. Like, here's what Kenneth Bailey just said. He lived in the Middle East for almost 50 years and studied Near East history. He'd say, I've never heard of a story like this. There is no ancient Greco-Roman, there is no ancient Jewish, there is no ancient Middle Eastern story, fable, tale, epic, anywhere that has a story where the superior washes the feet of an inferior. Like, it literally doesn't exist in history except with Jesus. Jesus is the master who serves. Jesus is the king who humbles himself. In Philippians chapter 2, Philippians is a book later in the New Testament. The Apostle Paul wrote Philippians. In Philippians chapter 2, there's this wonderful moment where Paul quotes this first century hymn or this first century poem. Maybe he wrote it, we don't know. But it's in Scripture, and it's this song about the glory of Jesus. And one of the things he says in the opening lines of this song, this hymn, this poem about Jesus, is Jesus being in very nature God. So what he says is that Jesus in his very nature, like his very ontological self, his full personhood, this is a theological concept, Jesus is God. He's the second member of the Trinity. He's equal in status and glory and stature and magnanimity and dignity and royalty. Jesus is God. He has all the very characteristics of God. He has all the identical qualities that make God God. He is the very substance of God. He is very God of very God. Jesus in his nature is God. Philippians chapter 2. It's all throughout the New Testament. But Philippians chapter 2, Paul says this, Jesus being in very nature God. Okay. A couple verses later in that same song, it says Jesus being in very nature a servant. And so you kind of go, wait. Well, is he God? Is his nature to be God? Is he truly God or is he truly a servant? And Paul would go, yes. Philippians 2 says that the very nature of God is to be a servant. He actually does this really cool wordplay where he says, taking on the nature of God and taking on the form, taking on the nature of a servant, he uses the same word, and Jesus is embodying both of them. All of the very nature of God is in Jesus, and all of the very nature of being a servant is in Jesus, and it's all held together in the God-man Jesus, that Jesus is God and Jesus is a servant, because God is a servant. Like when Jesus showed up, when God came in human form in the incarnation at Christmas and Jesus is born to a Virgin Mary, do you know that the world wasn't getting a new characteristic added to the attributes of God? Like when Jesus came to be a servant, he wasn't like enhancing or adding to what it meant to be God. God wasn't changing one thing about himself or his character when he came to serve. God is a servant. So when the world got to see Jesus and God take on human flesh, here's what the New Testament would say. You're getting to see what God is really like. He fully embodies everything that it means to be God, and he is a servant. In other words, Jesus wasn't losing his identity as God when he came to serve. Jesus was proving his identity as God when he came to serve. It's why it's one of the most repeated themes in all of Jesus' ministry is that he came to serve. It was from our call to worship. I really liked the call to worship this morning. I thought it was done really stellarly by a really handsome young man. It's my son. In Mark chapter 10, this was our call to worship, that the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. This is repeated everywhere. God, the infinite one, God, the transcendent one, God, the creator of stars at night, God, the Lord of nature and the Lord of power, is also a servant. To be God, fully God, means to be a servant, and Jesus embodies both of those things. Jesus came to serve. One of the things Kenneth Bailey, in his book, Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes, he talks about this little parable in Luke chapter 12. It's just this three-verse parable in Luke chapter 12, and you almost like forget it's even in there if you've ever even heard it. Jesus uses this little metaphor parable during this other larger teaching section, so it kind of gets glossed over, but it's just a little three-verse parable, and Kenneth Bailey makes a huge point about it. He writes a whole chapter on it. And it's this little story that tells the kingdom of heaven is like this. And it's the story of a master who's at a wedding feast. And in the ancient Near East, weddings would last a week or two. And once the wine got flowing and the buzz got going, like the party kept going all day and all night for weeks on end. And it tells the story of a master who's at a wedding feast. And it says in the middle of the wedding feast, like the party isn't even over yet, the master of the wedding feast leaves the party and goes back to his house. Now, maybe he was hosting the party. Maybe it was a family member of his. He doesn't go far. He goes back to his house to find his servants. And he's on his way back to find his servants. And it says when he opens the door, here's what it says. Allie, I think this is in there too. When he gets home, when the master gets home from the wedding feast, listen to what Luke 12, 37 says. Throw up verse 37. It says this. Blessed are those servants whom the master finds awake when he comes. Truly, I say to you, this is talking about the master now. He will dress himself for service and will have them recline at table, which means sit down to eat, lie down to eat, and he will come and serve them. He will dress himself for service and have them recline at table, and he will come and serve them. Okay, in the middle of a wedding feast, this little parable about a master that is Jesus, it's saying the master remembers his servants at home. And he so wants them to enjoy the wedding feast that he's getting to enjoy that would last for days on end. He's going, you know who I want to enjoy this? I want my servants at home to enjoy this. So he makes a tray of his own food because there's no mention of when he gets home that he like lights the gas fireplace and starts, they didn't have gas, when he like lights the fire and starts cooking dinner. He doesn't cook dinner for them. He takes a tray of food from the feast, the lamb and the bread and the wine and the cheese, and he brings it all back to his own house. He comes home with the tray full of food and he opens the door to his servants, and blessed are those servants who are awake when he gets there, because what's he gonna do? He wants them to sit down and enjoy the feast too. You sit down. No, let me dress myself for service. Take out my outer garments and put a towel around my waist. I want to serve you dinner. The master in that little parable doesn't even send like a waiter or a servant from the wedding feast, which there would have been plenty there too. He could have said, hey, I'm a few drinks in, I'm a little buzzed, so I need you, servant, to go back to my quarters. I need you to go back and serve my servants that are back at home because I really want them to eat tonight too. No. He doesn't send anyone else. For this master, sending a servant to do the serving was not good enough. He wanted to go serve his servants himself. And Kenneth Bailey, commenting on this, says, is there any culture anywhere in the world where such an act is not shocking? Masters don't serve servants. Kings don't get down on their knees. But Jesus does. And here we have in John 13, Jesus living out that little parable from Luke chapter 12. He's showing you what it means to be God, because God is a servant. And it wasn't good enough for him to send some other waiter or some other servant to go and serve his people. He wanted to come do it. But Jesus doesn't only want to like culture shock them and wash their feet. Jesus actually wants to use this little interaction as a parable, as a metaphor. He does this. He's washing their feet, and then he goes into a teaching mode, teaching about what he's about to do the next day, because he knows that's coming, and how what he's doing by washing their feet at the table, what it means. He's doing it to show them humility. He's doing it to serve them, to clean their feet, but he's using that action as a parable and a metaphor of what his sacrificial death the next day will do to them. And so with all the cultural shock of what's going on, Jesus begins washing their feet, and it's immediately resisted and misunderstood by Peter, not surprisingly. In verse 6, look at what Peter says. Look at what happens when he comes to Peter. It says, he came to Simon Peter, who said to him, Lord, do you wash my feet? And the way that the Greek and the grammar of that sentence from Peter is even written would be like an offended moment from Peter. Like where the emphasis lies in the language would be him saying, are you going to wash my feet? Like, I don't need this. Like, these losers, they're not the greatest. They might need it, but like, I don't need you to do this for me. You're not going to wash my feet. And look at how Jesus responds to Peter's resistance in the following verses. Verse 7, Jesus answered him, what I'm going to do, you do not understand now, but afterward you will understand. Peter said to him, you shall never wash my feet. Can you imagine being imperative, commanding Jesus? You're never going to wash my feet. So Jesus meets him in that place and is equally uses the equal amount of bluntness back. Jesus answered him, if I do not wash you, you have no share with me. Verse 9, Simon Peter said to him, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. Jesus said to him, the one who has bathed does not need to wash except for his feet, but is completely clean, and you are clean, but not every one of you. So Jesus is using the foot washing to teach about the kind of washing that the listener and the reader and the disciples needs for their whole self, like their whole soul, their whole sense of existence needs a washing that is like the foot washing that he's giving them. And it's so necessary that Jesus make this point that like, it's not just about this action I'm doing right now. It's about like your whole personhood, your whole sense of self needs to be washed like I'm washing your feet. That Jesus says it that bluntly back. If I do not wash you, you have no share with me. Which is a startling statement. It should shock you awake a little bit that Jesus would speak that forcefully. He's saying, if I don't clean you, you can't share in the world of my kingdom. You have no share with me. Like if I don't clean you, you're not going to get to experience the wholeness and the beauty and the joy of my kingdom. If I don't clean you, you don't get to share in the liberation of what I came to do for you and for the world. If I don't clean you, you don't get to experience the mission of the kingdom, and you don't get to experience the healing of the kingdom. If I don't clean you, you have no share with me. Those are startling words from Jesus. And so what do you think it's like to try to say to someone, you need to be cleaned? Like, you need a cleansing. People tell me all the time I need to wash my hair more. Hurts a little bit. The whole staff team here about a year and a half ago told me, like, we think you have a problem. You need to wash your hair more. And I'm offended. What do you, like, take like a comical, which maybe you would say, like, we're not joking, you do, but take like a comical, like, hey, come on. Take that into, what do you think it's like when someone says, your soul is as stained as first century feet, covered in mire, covered in disgustingness. Your soul needs this. Like, do you feel the offense of that? So Peter feels it. He's representing a little like, whoa, hold on. What are you saying? It's remarkably offensive to tell someone your whole self needs to be cleansed. It's offensive unless you're tired of trying to dance around the reality of the stain that you know you feel inside. And it's remarkably offensive unless and this is something that all of us, I think, can relate to if we're honest. It's remarkably offensive to tell someone your whole sense of self needs to be cleansed unless you're exhausted from trying to like name what you feel and know to be true inside, but you don't have a language to match it. It's hard for us. We don't want to call it what Scripture says. It's tough. It's offensive. Like, your soul is stained. It's as dirty as first century feet. Do you know how disgusting first century feet were? We have less than sufficient descriptions. There's a whole article written this week in The Atlantic. It's a great article about the guy who's not a believer said, I think I finally have a word for what I'm watching happen in the AI world, and I'm not anti-AI, I love it. I use it all the time. But he says, what I'm seeing in this like creation of what's happening in AI world and behind closed doors in AI circles, he said, I think I finally found a word for it. It's called sin. But I don't wanna call it that because I hate that word. But I need to call it something, and this is what it feels like. It feels evil, what I hear and what I know. And The Atlantic, he's not even a Christian. He's like, I hate that word, but that feels like the right word. What our hands have done, what our minds have thought, what our heart has willed, what's been done to us, the Bible would say has left you stained. And Jesus here is saying, please hear, with the offense of the declaration, if I don't clean you, you have no share with me. In that same offensive statement, he's also saying, let me clean you. Let my bloody hands wash away your stain. Don't you want to be whiter than snow? Can I like scrub what sin has done to you? Can I scrub it off of you? That's what Jesus is offering. It's what this whole foot washing is symbolizing. And Jesus does make this helpful distinction. He like goes into the metaphor and he uses some stuff for them that they would have comprehended, where he's like, when Peter's like, oh great, wash my whole body then. If that's what you came to wash, wash my whole body. And Jesus is like, well, there is a difference between like the daily foot washing that you might need in the first century, like you're gonna get dirty every day. And this other like once for all permanent cleansing that Jesus can do for you. And both those things live together in the kingdom. Both of those things live together in the life of the Christian, where it's like there is a once and for all cleaning that Jesus offers. He's willing to do it. And there's like this still this daily need, like your feet are gonna get dirty. And you need to remember the cleansing that you have. You need to like let your feet be washed again, metaphorically so. But this is what he's offering them. He's offering them both things, but he's saying ultimately, I have a once and for all cleansing that I'm offering you. He says, unless I clean you. Which is interesting that he doesn't say, unless you work really hard, unless you get your life together, unless you gather up some resume, unless you get some of like the crusty dirt off of you first, you have no part in me. You have no share in me. He doesn't say that. He also doesn't say, which I find this remarkable, because he absolutely could have said this, unless you wash my feet, you have no share with me. He doesn't say that. Any king could have said that. He says, unless I wash you, unless I clean you. And what's remarkable, if you can kind of go there in your imagination, like go to the upper room, go to this moment where you're laying down at the table, the feet are disgusting, a servant didn't come to do it, and you start arguing with the other disciples about who's the greatest amongst us, and then Jesus starts walking around the room and starts washing your feet, and you're kind of like, okay, I'm feeling the uncomfortableness of this, and then you watch the interaction happen with Peter, which would have been an Enneagram 9's worst nightmare, right? And then like he makes his way over to you. Imagine this declaration that everyone heard of, like, unless I clean you, and Jesus is saying, you need to be cleaned. And also what he's saying is, and I'm willing to clean you. He offers the cleansing while he's washing their feet. Which means the one qualification that he gives for experiencing the bliss and the beauty of the kingdom, which is unless I clean you, you have no share with me. He says, unless I clean you, and he says it to them while he's cleaning them. Meaning he is at the very same moment that he offers and declares the need, he's meeting the need. There's a giant need, and he's saying, and I'm more than willing to meet it. I don't know if there's a better summary or even like summary moment of all of Christianity than this moment in the upper room when he's washing their feet. He is saying, this is nothing of merit and it's all of mercy. Whatever degree of your stain, Jesus can wash you. The only qualification for having any share in the blessings of God is that you have been washed by Jesus, and Jesus tells you that while he washes your feet. There is like no hurdle. There is no like mountain to climb. There is no proof that you need. There is no, I have to like drum up enough evidence to show that I'm really serious. Like all that is gone. Jesus offers to clean you. And he's saying, if he's washed you, he says this so clearly here, that the cleaning he offers is more permanent than the staining. Saying the dirt, what sin has done to you, cannot be used against you anymore. The cleansing that you need cannot bring you into condemnation anymore. It's like when stain on clothes meets bleach, the stain is removed. It's gone. All of your guilt, all of your future guilt, anything you've ever done or will do is taken away from you. You have been washed by Jesus. You have a new statement over you. He gives it to you right here. Look at verse 10. This is in his like once and for all permanent cleaning versus like the daily need for cleansing what gets dirty again. The one who has bathed does not need to wash except for his feet, because those are going to get dirty every day out in the world. But the one who has bathed does not need to wash except for his feet, but is like the person existentially, ontologically, their being is clean. Very next line. And you are clean. He's removed the stain. It's permanent. He's giving them a new status. You are clean because of what I've done for you. He's speaking a final word over them because of the work that he will do the next day. It will cleanse them once and for all. Other religions, most other religions, will tell you you need a cleansing. And they might even give you a pathway towards that cleansing. None of them will tell you that the master does the cleaning for you. And none of them will tell you that the cleansing is permanent. And so after Jesus, the master, the king, washes them, he gives them the mandi, he gives them the mandate. He says, because I've washed you, in light of what I've done for you, do you know what it's going to do to you? Do you know what it ought to propel you into? It'll make you go and serve others. And that doesn't mean like you take the exact form that like the only way to serve is to go wash other people's feet. It makes you a servant in the world. Like you'll be in co-rights and you won't care who gets the credit, which is like career suicide for all industries, but especially the music scene in this town. To not care who gets the credit, you can't afford to do that. Or you'll be with your in-laws or you'll be with your spouse and you won't have to win any argument or any culture war discussion. Or you'll go into the world and you'll ask what other people need from you before you start asking what you need from them. Or you'll never be too important for a task, too important for a conversation, or too important for a correction. You'll be a servant. You will go into the world and you will serve the world. It's why humility is like a universal Christian virtue in every sect of Christianity. Humility is a requirement. It's a non-negotiable. It's what our master has demonstrated in dealing with us. Humility and humble servanthood should be what would mark the church in the world. We are a people who serve. We're a people who serve. That's what we should be known by. We're a people who humbly serve because it's what our master has done for us. And if you want to like extract from the story, like what does that mean and what categories would you put that in? And okay, you gave some examples of, you know, whatever, but how would I frame that as I enter the world? Well, if you want to learn from the story, here's what it would mean for you. And this can apply to everyone in the room at any age, in any role. It means that you serve those that are beneath you, whatever that means. It means you serve those who have been dirtied by the world, stained by the world, stained on their own. You serve those beneath you. You serve those who've been dirtied by the world. And then if you want to follow the logic and the teaching and the example that Jesus gives, here's what else it means. you and I, the church, ought to be serving those who don't deserve it. Do you know why? Because guess who was in the room when Jesus washed feet? Judas. It's like said like five times in here. Judas Iscariot was there. Jesus already knew that Judas was going to betray him. And Jesus doesn't wait till Judas leaves the room to go betray him. And then he goes, all right, now that we got him out of here, let me serve your feet. Let me wash your feet. He actually does it knowing that Judas is in the room and knowing that Judas is going to betray him. Meaning, Christian, serving others and being misunderstood while you are doing it is maybe the most Christ-like thing you could ever do. Serving people who you might even know when you do it, they're not going to get it. They're not going to be grateful for it. They're not even going to come back and thank you for it. They're not even going to know what it took for you to serve them. Do you know that Jesus, when he's washing Judas's feet, doesn't go, Judas, like, I know what you're about to do, bro. Can you believe what I'm doing for you? Yes. So was Judas. That was phenomenal. Like, what does it mean in this example from Jesus that he would literally serve someone knowing that they were going to betray him and never even bring that up? It's like, it's a category shifting way to think about your role in the world. And he says it. It's the mandate. Go and do likewise. And you won't have a clue how to do it. You certainly won't have the power to serve like that if you don't let yourself first be served and be washed by him. Like, do you realize what being served by Jesus, being washed by Jesus like this can do for you? Do you realize the identity that this gives you? And you may go, wait, how does me letting Jesus wash my feet give me an identity? Well, who are you? You're one who has been served by the King. You're one who has been loved to the end, as verse 1 says, or loved to the uttermost by Jesus. Like that, do you realize if that's who you know yourself to be, I've been served by the King. That can change you. Because now I'm not going into the world demanding that everyone else serve me. I get to actually, I've already been served by Jesus, so now I can come and serve you. I have a new identity. I have been changed. I have been cleansed. I've been transformed by my King. And so now with this new identity, I don't have to go into the world demanding that they serve me. I get to serve them. Church father from the Middle Ages, a Middle Eastern scholar who Kenneth Bailey references a lot in this chapter. His name was Matah al-Maskin. He says this about this scene. Listen to the transformation that happens, what he's saying, like what it did to the disciples, what it does to us when you are served by Jesus. Listen to how it affects you and transforms you. Listen to what he says. He says, this is where the slave ceases to be a slave and becomes a partner in love and a partner in glory. This is where a slave ceases to be a slave. You're not a slave anymore. You're a partner with Jesus, with the King, a partner in love and a partner in glory. It's a new identity. And do you know it's like not enough for you to just intellectually assent to what Philippians 2 or John 13 would say, like, oh, Jesus is a servant. That's great to know theologically, Jesus is a servant. You have to experience it. You have to actually like the palate of your heart has to taste this. Like, hypothetical mercy is not transformative. Encountering Jesus serving you and cleansing you with your dirtiest stains and washing you can transform you. You have to let Jesus serve you. You have to let Jesus cleanse you, which is the hardest thing. That's why Peter is such a helpful example. Like, we fight this. We resist this. If you're going to be transformed by King Jesus and let his hands of healing heal you, you have to quit fighting it. You have to let him clean you. You have to quit trying to clean up before you go to him. I love the passiveness of the disciples here. Like, they don't mix the soap and water. They don't dry their feet off. They just have to let Jesus serve them. Do you know what actually makes it worse if they're like kicking their feet around? Like, just sit still, sit still. Let me serve you. Stop. Let me serve you. Let me help you. They don't force it, manipulate it, or control it. They let themselves be served. So apply this, closing with this. Is there a situation in your life right now, and it could be anything, but a situation in your life that is maybe too heavy to pick up because it's too complicated, it's too painful or frustrating to try to like think your way through, or it's too shameful to remember? It could be anything. Are you kicking your feet, scurrying around in your soul, trying to control it and force it and manipulate it? I have to make sure it goes this way, and I have to get my grip on it and get my understanding around it and get my plan for it and I got to talk about it and think about it. And is all of that you kicking your feet instead of letting Jesus serve you? In fact, and I know this is painful to say, he may even have you in the middle of a tumble cycle right now, so that you would loosen your grip of control on the situation and on your own life, so that you would be more likely to let him serve you. Your king is known by mercy, and his hands are hands of healing. He's the king who comes from the wedding feast and invites you to lie down at the table so that he might serve you, and blessed are those servants who let him. Let's pray. Jesus, maybe the hardest thing is to let you serve us. It's why Peter it's so helpful. Thank you for including Peter in this retelling of the story, that we don't want to let you serve us. But Jesus, crush our pride. Whatever situation we think we can handle, whatever storyline we think is ours to do and fix and cleanse ourselves, before you send us back into it as servants, would you let us let you serve us? And see the king on his knees before us, saying, "Let me clean you." We ask all this in your name, Jesus. Amen.